any questions about anything on the consent form or anything like that?
No, I didn't have any questions. I didn't have any questions.
Okay. And then before we start, I just wanted to say that nothing you say in this interview can be wrong. And that is just an opportunity for you to share your story. So you shouldn't feel any pressure. Just say like certain things. But if you're ready, we can just get right into it. And my first question is, what can you recall to be your first time being an activist or a change maker?
Yeah, I would say my first time being an activist and like really act or speaking out was in middle school, actually. I had an experience where I went to a predominantly white middle school and have been in predominantly white school settings for all of K through 12 for me. And so I'm at middle school. There was a situation where I was like walking in the hallway with some friends and a boy had like bumped into us and I was like, excuse you. And then he was like, move inward. And that was like a really intense experience for myself and like for my friends. And of course, you know, I was very upset. My friends were very upset. And the way that I reacted, of course, was like very like, at first I was like really frozen and like shocked, like, hold on, like, did that actually just happen? And then it was, you know, frustrated. But I used it as an opportunity to speak up and like not to just let that die in that moment. And so I like went to like my administration and I like let them know like what had happened. Even the way like my school reacted was not the best. And I wish that I would have put more pressure on like my administration to respond and to do more. And the boy ended up getting a write up. And then I like, because I was so upset, like I like cussed, you know, back at the boy. And so I ended up getting a write up too, because he told them that I was like cussing at him and things of that sort. So like I got a write up. And looking back now, I wish that I was more vocal. But I do think me still speaking up and like letting them know what happened was a bit of a form of activism, just because I didn't let that experience just pass by, but use it as an opportunity to like let them know what was going on. But now looking back, I do wish that I would have like, you know, put more pressure on my administration, especially when they came back and like put the same disciplinary infraction on me than they did him for cursing at him, even though he used like a very derogatory term to me as well initially. So that was like pretty tough, but it really wasn't until my later years of high school that I really started to be more vocal, because I didn't really feel empowered to do such. So even me like speaking about it to my administration and like the staff that were nearby was a big step for me at that point, because I didn't feel as empowered in my voice as I started to later down the line.
Well, I'm sorry that happened, but that also, that reminds me, did you hear about the Wilmington Speaks, about how a lot of the private schools in Wilmington around 2020, were you also involved in that or hear about that?
Excuse me. Okay. So yes, I heard of the Wilmington Speaks, and like I followed a lot of it, and I actually as a result of the Wilmington Speaks page for the private schools, I created the NCCVT Speaks for the Newcastle Countyville Techs in Delaware, because I saw like, you know, how much traction the Wilmington Speaks was, and I'm like, wow, like I know that there's a lot of stories that people within my school district like could share, and I'm sure they would benefit from this platform. And it initially started with, because I had asked the Wilmington Speaks page, like, hey, like, can Votex students like share their stories on this page? Like, would you eventually? Because I remember them like doing like posts that were tailored to like each school, and I'm like, hey, like, can we expand this to like include Votex? And they were like, yeah, no, we're like pretty like, we're pretty busy right now, like getting so many stories, but we'll eventually like expand to Votex. And I remember like following up, and then like they had never said anything, understandably, because they were so busy. But then I was like, you know what, why not use it as an opportunity to make one myself? And so that's what I did.
And did you receive any like school pushback from the creation of Instagram?
Absolutely. absolutely. Yeah. So initially it was, I mean, the page was always anonymous. But at that point, the time that I created the page, I was already kind of known within my high school to be like a little bit more vocal, and outspoken. And so they kind of quickly identified who was behind the page. And then I made the page with like another friend, and she also made the error of creating the page with her school email. Oh. So they were able to like, you know, get into the page and see who made it anyway. And so they quickly figured out who was behind the page. And once they did, of course, they were like really upset. They scheduled meetings with us and like, you know, it was like, what are you guys doing? Like, you need to take down this page and all this crazy stuff. So yeah, it was very, very, not popular within my school district. And like I said, like they were like, this needs to come down immediately. I will never forget the day that like my principal found out that it was me behind the page. I was literally at the beach with one of my best friends, and he was blowing up my phone. It was like a Saturday, and he was blowing up my phone. I'm like, what is going on? Like, why are you blowing up my phone? And so I'm like, hello. And he was like, you know, I'm calling you. And I'm like, get off my phone. And it was just a really crazy, unserious, unreal experience. And yeah, the time was also just such a blur because so much was happening at one time, and it was very overwhelming. But it got a lot of pushback.
Yeah, the one, I went to Tower Hill, and there was a lot of pushback because there were a lot of posts about our school.
Nice. Yeah, and then yours was made by an alum, right? Yes. Or was it?
And they actually ended up, like, sending, people ended up finding his address, and his, like, whole security was threatened.
They found his address? Yes,
it was a whole thing, but...
Oh, my goodness.
Kind of pivoting.
Intense.
No, it was. It was a tense. I was worried for him. They were emailing his, like, bosses, where he was working.
What?
It was really tense. But kind of thinking about administration's response to both, like, what happened at my school and the both Instagram pages, how do you think administrations can better support students of color?
Excuse me. Yeah, I think administrations and overall just leaders within the education space can do a much better job of supporting students of color. I think it starts with creating more space for them, for students of color to lead and show up authentically and not trying to silence their voices, silence their stories, silence their perspectives. I think it's very important that it's encouraged for them to show up as authentically as possible, and that space is created for them to do so. In the rooms where, you know, the decisions are being made, and maybe even in the rooms where they aren't. But that representation is really key. And then I also think it's important that, you know, administration seeks to build that like trust in that relationship and overall increase that degree of proximity too. Because the reality is that there is a lot of distrust between students and education leaders, especially students of color, just because of how disproportionately we've been affected and overall like misused and mishandled by the education system. And so I think it's up to the education leaders and the administration to do their part in helping rectify and heal that relationship and that lack of trust between students and them, and doing the work to increase that like proximity to students of color, understanding their stories, learning their stories, and just overall becoming a part of their stories in a positive way.
And what do you think would be the kind of the difference between like performative listening by administration and listening to take action?
Yeah, so I think it literally just starts with taking action. I think the performative listening, that's something that I also like experienced a lot as well, especially around the time that I was doing the NCCBT Speaks page and just a lot of activism around the state. You saw that a lot of people are just like, or especially with my administration, were trying to hear the solution while also strategizing on how to like silence my voice and like take down the page. And so there was not really a genuine approach to understanding like what was going on behind the page. And even like, I remember like my administration submitting fake stories to the page to like discredit and like admitting that they like submitted fake stories to the page to overall discredit like what was being posted on the page and attempt to like do so. Because transparently there wasn't really much of a process we had to like streamline and like really tweak or not tweak, but like go through different stories, like a needle in a haystack. Like it was like finding a needle in a haystack. And so we would like, of course, do like a broad, inspection of the stories, but it's hard to like really, see like if something is like 100% accurate or not. So even the fact that like my administration tried to, even discredit like what was being told on our page, by submitting fake stories was insane. And so to answer your question, I think it's important that instead of just like listening to be seen, because you'll see that a lot of people do the DEI things and do the inclusivity things to check off a box and to overall be seen for quote unquote doing the work. But I think it just starts with actually doing the work. It starts with that action. Yeah, it's one thing to listen, but what are you doing as a result? What tangibles are you taking away from the conversations that are being had? How are you making an effort to listen more actively and consistently, but also to listen with the intent of finding solutions and not in a and not adopting like a saverism mentality, but one where it's like you're committed truly to helping the people that you're serving with a pure heart and intent.
And what action would you have liked to see from your administration?
I would have liked to see, and I will say, like, because there was so much, like, pressure on my administration, they eventually, like, started to do things better. And so we did start to see action. So we were able to get Black student unions within, or affinity spaces for various communities, marginalized communities, not only within my specific high school, but the entire school district. They hired DEI officers, district-wide DEI officers. They like host yearly summits for students, specifically, you know, they call it like a Unity Day Summit. And so it's one that like unifies the students within the district and talks about a plethora of conversations. And that's something that they have been committed to yearly. So that's something that they did, but I think something that they could have done better initially was just having more of a sense of urgency towards doing the right thing. I think they were more focused on silencing us and stopping what was going on the page compared to then just having more of a sense of urgency around what was going on and like a genuine concern for what was going on and an overall genuine like desire to help the students that were sharing such hurtful experiences and just really deep stories.
And would you like to talk more about the process around how this change was created and maybe your part in it?
Yeah, so it was, so actually before I created the page, I was already kind of advocating to have a Black student union, and it was something that like there was never really a sense of urgency around within my high school. It was always like, okay, well, if we do a Black student union, what about the white students? Like, we're going to have to do a white student union and those types of conversations. And so that was obviously something that was very disappointing and discouraging to hear. But like, I still tried to keep the conversation going. And then eventually the page was created. And because of the momentum that was behind the page, we used it as an opportunity to create a list of demands. So that's what we did. We created a list of demands. So as a result of the list of demands, they kind of were able to see like what tangibles we wanted to see. And so, you know, eventually they, you know, were able to meet those tangibles. So they created a task force of students, and they actually asked me to be a part of the task force of students to like spearhead like this work. And so they created the task force, and it was like of students across excuse me, the different high schools within the school district. And we overall, like, you know, planned the implementation of the different affinity spaces. We planned the conference, or helped to plan and strategize behind the conference. And it was long, it was year long work. It took about a year, to be fully like implemented. And the task force still exists to this day. And like even the task force is divided now, like it's a overall overarching for each high school, or for covering all four high schools. And then there's one in each high school. And it kind of just like is a committee that advises the diversity initiatives that are happening within the schools and also within the overall school district.
Wow, that's really impressive. But also, was the creation of these affinity spaces connected to like your creation of the Black Student Coalition, or were those kind of two separate things?
Yeah, so they were two separate. So I actually created the Delaware Black Student Coalition because there was so much pushback that I was receiving for the Black Student Union. And so the Black Student Union is something that came along the way, but they're not like really connected. And I actually, it's actually so crazy how like it all happened. So I had reached out to one friend who went to school in Lower Delaware, and she was a part of the Black Student Union and president of the Black Student Union at her school. And I let her know like the issues I was having. I'm like, hey, like, do you have, and she started the Black Student Union at her school, and I was like, do you have like any insight on like starting a Black Student Union? And then she put me into a group chat with a few other girls in Lower Delaware that started their Black Student Unions. And then next thing you know, we like connected with another girl, and then we just like became, it was a total of seven of us total. And we like got super close off of helping me create my Black Student Union. I was literally the only one in the group that wasn't, I didn't have a Black Student Union. And so they all like were presidents of theirs or founders, and were like supporting me. And then we got so close, we were like, okay, well, why don't we just, this space is so powerful and so beneficial. Why don't we expand this and open it up to students across the state of Delaware? Because at that point, our friend group went as low as a little past Dover area. Yeah. And then for me, I was in Wilmington. So we literally spanned across the top to bottom of Delaware. And so we had the outreach to students within Delaware. And so we overall were just like, well, why don't we just do this for students within Delaware? Because I, you know, was able to experience firsthand how powerful this space was. And I'm like, you know, my school is still not letting me start the Black Student Union. So why don't we just do a statewide Black Student Union for students within the state? And that's what we did, and it was such a beautiful space. And to this day, I like still like reminisce on like how beautiful things were like when they were. And then unfortunately, we each graduated high school, and literally all of us went to different schools outside of Delaware. Mm-hmm. And so one of the girls in the space, Amanda, she went as far as California. I'm in D.C. Another one went to Illinois. Another one went to New York. So we were literally everywhere. And it was just so hard for us to like maintain, you know, what we had created within Delaware while still being everywhere, you know, for college and also just transitioning to college. And it was really hard to sustain the space. So now org United Way of Delaware kind of took the Delaware Black Student Coalition under their kind of subsection of initiatives. And they're not necessarily the Delaware Black Student Coalition, but they kind of adopted a lot of our initiatives and kind of partners in part with us with the like events that they do. So they do a Delaware Black Student Summit.
And what kind of initiatives were you guys working on in the coalition?
Yeah, so we were really just, oh my gosh, it was such a beautiful space. Like, I literally, like, think about it frequently now. But so we overall just, it was really, like, a statewide Black Student Union. So we had, but we just did things on a larger scale. So mm-hmm. we would do speaker series. So we would like, and we had such a great, like so many people like wanted to support us and like help us. And so we did like different speaker series. So like state legislators would like host webinar. We would host webinars of different state legislators or nonprofit leaders within the state. And they would like talk, and we would do like these very successful, like it would have great turnouts of just like conversations. And also it was during the pandemic, so everything was happening virtually anyway, so everyone was just looking for things to tune into, so they would tune into our webinars and we would discuss different topics. And then we would like go on Instagram Live and do different conversations as well and discuss like different topics. And then we would also try to like do super high engagement on our Instagram page as well. So we would do like different like posts that were like informative. So I remember we had a really successful thread on like discussing AAVE, mm-hmm. code switching, like just different topics pertaining to the Black community. And then we also helped like the students that were in the Delaware Black Student Coalition that weren't a part of Black student unions within their schools create Black student unions within their schools. So we helped a friend, she was starting one at William Penn, or we're trying to start one at William Penn. So we advised her on that process. We helped another student what school was she at? Oh my God, I'm forgetting what school she was at. But we helped another student come up with a plan to start her Black student union. So yeah, it was a really powerful space. And we like coached the students within the Black Student Union on like just how to lead efficiently and effectively, and really just was like mobilizing a bunch of Black students to lead and be change makers within their schools, within their states. And also a big thing that we did was we were co-sponsors for House Bill 198. And so that's something that I kind of led and made sure to loop the Delaware Black Student Coalition into. And so House Bill 198 is a bill that mandates Black studies in K-12 curriculum in Delaware. And so myself and one other student in Delaware directly had a hand in the process and the crafting of the legislation. Tyler Bush is the other student. And we like literally like advised the legislators on like what students wanted to see, what's needed to be included and mandated within the piece of legislation. And so we literally served as like expert witnesses. I like advocated to get the Delaware Black Student Coalition listed on the bill as a co-sponsor and like as an expert within the bill. And then even when the time came for like public comment and like perspectives, I like was able to coach like a bunch of students that were in the Delaware Black Student Coalition through like doing that public comment. So it was so beautiful. And like so many people raved about it, because you'll just hear like so many students like sharing their stories and sharing such powerful testimonies on why this bill needed to be passed. And like, if not all, most of those students were part of the Delaware Black Student Coalition and were able to like find out about that opportunity through me being a part of that and like ensuring that like their stories were heard in that process. And we like would often like refer, like, because a lot of people were like reaching out to me to like do speaking engagements. And I'm like, you know, I'm not the only student that needs to be heard. And so I would often like pull on the students that were in the Delaware Black Student Coalition and allow their voices to be honored and highlighted. But yeah, overall, it was, if you really just think of a Black student union, it was that, but just on a state level. And it was such a beautiful space.
That's so amazing. It's crazy to think that I'm still living in Delaware. Well, I was living in Delaware, and I didn't even know that whole thing happened, but that's really amazing that you guys passed that. And mm-hmm. how did you guys come up with this idea? Or, like, could you tell me more about the process of when, of how it came about?
Yeah, so, like I said, it was seven of us, and so it started with them trying to support me and creating the Black Student Union within my high school. And I, like I said, they all were presidents or founders of their Black Student Unions. And yeah, they all were presidents or founders. And then I was the only one that like didn't have one. And so yeah, so they like were supporting me, and then we just got super close out of nowhere, just because we were talking like almost every day. And then we like created a group chat, and yeah, we were talking like every day, and it was such a beautiful space of, you know, Black women that were just on fire. And we were all just doing such amazing things throughout the state, within our Black scenes and beyond. And so then one day we were like, why don't we just like create an organization? You know, since my school was giving me so much pushback, I was the only one that didn't have a Black scene within my high school, or yeah, within my high school. And we were just like, why don't we just create this on a large scale across the state? And we didn't think much about it, and we just did it. And looking back, like, there's so much ways, there's so many things that we could have done better, and like more efficiently. But we were young, we were just on fire, just trying to do something. And it was a beautiful while it lasted. It was so beautiful. It was so beautiful. And sometimes I'm like, wow, we need to like bring something like this back. Like, we were so like radical in the ways in which we approached it. Like, it's actually so funny thinking back now, because we were so like, we were so passionate about just being like student-led, student-run. And so anytime like we felt like adults were like doing too much, we were like, you know, this is a student-led space, a student-run space. Like, we value your perspective, but this is student-led, student-run, for students, by students. And yeah, so that was pretty much the primary driving factor, was just because we saw how powerful our space was within our group chat. We knew that so many students could benefit from the type of conversations that we were having, and also from the type of spaces that we were in. Like, we were in so many spaces individually and still are doing so many amazing things. Like, Amanda, actually, she is one of the co-founders, and she is now like an Obama Voyager scholar, and even, yeah, so doing amazing things. And I know Elise is, you know, doing great things at Spelman. And then, you know, of course, I'm at Howard, and we have another one that's at Loyola, and just all over the place. And so it just is so beautiful, like, just to see how much everyone is growing and just doing amazing things in their own fields and spaces, and just seeing how, like, they're just dominating. And yeah, we just, like, we need to, like, pour this wisdom into other people and, like, explore and expand this community.
And how else do you think we could create these other spaces? Because you talked about like how you're so nostalgic for it. How do you think we could have them? Like, do you think we could have them on colleges and incorporate them throughout like the country?
How? I think it starts with just doing it. Like, I think we spend too much time thinking and talking and talking, but it really just starts with doing it, because the need is now. People need these spaces now. And even like this conversation is like making me think like, hold on, we might need to start this again, because there's such a need for it. And so many people need like these spaces. And so I think just going for it and starting it, because people thrive off of on having community, and being in community with people, and you learn so much from it. And so, yeah, I think it just starts with just doing it, on colleges, within high schools, middle schools, wherever it may be. I think just having spaces for people to be in community with one another is essential. And it doesn't just have to be based off of your racial identity, but it can be similar to like your passions or things that you enjoy talking about or fighting for, whatever it may be. I just think that community aspect is so essential and so important. And it's foundational for me in the work that I do.
And would you like to talk a little bit more about the community you have and who's supporting you throughout all this activism?
Yeah. So now I'm at an HBCU, and so I think just being a part of this entire HBCU community, it's such a beautiful space of people that are driven and amazing leaders and doing amazing things in their fields. I have learned so much just off the strength of being a student at Howard, and just being in community with like all of the individuals that are in this amazing school. They're so brilliant, and just so on fire for the things that they're passionate about. And it varies, because I think a lot of people think because I'm at an HBCU, we're all the same and we're all a monolith, but that is not true at all. If not now, then before, I've learned so much about different cultures and different experiences and different thoughts from just like the different people that are here at Howard. In addition to my Howard and HBCU community, I would say my church community, I'm also like a person of faith. And so my church community has been very, very, very essential to me. And especially as I grow into my faith more, because it's something that I've recently grown into and has become more of a central piece in like my day to day. And so like my church community is just such a beautiful community that I have outside of the work, outside of the academics. They're just great to like go to when I need kind of that like unplug, and that separate, that separate space. And then in addition to that, of course, just my family. I'm very, very, very family oriented. And so just being able to, again, like when I need to unplug, just go home, take a train ride home, because I'm only about 2 hours from home. And so just being able to like go home and like just be in community with my family and just receive all the love that they have to give is something that's really healing for me too.
Thank you. That was really beautiful. And so my next question is, who inspires you the most, or who or what inspires you to do all this change making?
I would say I'm inspired by, it's cliche, but like all of the little Black girls and little Black boys that I see on a day-to-day basis. I'm inspired to be a part of a world that treats them better and sees them more than they see us today, and that they see our ancestors, or seen our ancestors. I'm inspired by them and the legacy that they will have and the work that they will do. I don't want it to always be as hard. And the reality of it is, we live in a world where the system is designed to be hard for us, but I don't want it to be. And so I'm inspired and fueled to do this work so it doesn't have to be as hard for them when they come, and the next leaders, the next advocates, the next change makers come, that hopefully we won't be fighting for the same thing. And the fight will look just a little bit different. And so I'm inspired by their lives and their fire and their innocence as well. And of course, as you grow with time and age, you start to lose that innocence. But I am committed to kind of trying to preserve a bit of it. And I just don't want certain things to reach them. And so that's something that inspires me a lot. I'm also inspired a lot by leaders that have come before me. Somebody that, I'm a political science major, and so someone that inspires me a lot is Shirley Chisholm. I'm just so inspired by the way that she dared to show up and to take up space. And as you know, one of the first Black women to run for a presidential office, and just her daringness and her boldness, it is a reminder to me that nothing's ever too big for me to try and to do. And I should never limit myself, limit my voice, or try to put a cap on my power. And I'm inspired to take up the space in politics and government because I see Black women do it every day and dominate and excel in this space.
And what would be your biggest piece of advice to the to young Black girls and boys who would also want to be change makers or activists?
My biggest piece of advice to young Black boys and girls that want to be change makers and activists would be, to keep going, keep soaring, and to keep daring. Don't ever, stop or to dim your light for anyone, because it can be easy to, this can be very discouraging work. It can be work where you may feel like you aren't equipped or you aren't qualified to do it. But to keep daring, keep going, keep trying, because there is purpose in the work that you're doing. There's power in the work that you're doing. Lives are drastically being changed by you speaking up, by you using your voice, and by you daring to continue advocating and to continue being persistent and pressing on and putting your foot basically on a system that has systemic or historically put its foot on us. So, yeah.
And what would you say is your best way to fight against burnout when you come across like a disappointing moment when you're doing your work?
Also, excuse, I don't know if you hear like a ringing sound.
There's
My
people talking outside my dorm. It's okay.
okay, I'm like I don't know what it is, but yeah. I would say to track the small wins, the little wins, and to create space for gratitude every day. Because this can be like discouraging work where the no's can be feel and seem louder than the wins or the yeses. But it's important to center yourself in gratitude daily so that you don't lose sight of where you are and you know the many great things that are happening while you know it can be discouraging to hear no or to just not seem like you're getting as far as you would like to get. So I think it's important to center yourself in gratitude and to track the small wins, track the small steps and small goals that are being met because that's essential. Because if you don't, then you'll let the no's or the things, the hurdles stop you from doing this work. And then also remember why you're doing this work. It's okay to unplug when it gets hard. Like you're entitled to that. You're entitled to take a break. You're entitled to breathe. But I think remembering your why can be really fueling in those moments when you decide that you don't want to do it anymore or it's not for you anymore. Your why should keep you up at night. Your why should cause you to feel uncomfortable when you aren't working towards it. And so I think just also keeping your why at the forefront and being able to even define it is really important.
And so, in addition to these acts of gratitude, like of thinking about gratitude and thinking about your why, do you also practice any self-care? And what does that look like for you?
Absolutely. I think I'm learning now more what self-care looks like for me because transparently, I reached a burnout myself because I was just going at 100 miles per hour and I wasn't creating space, one, for myself to give gratitude or experience gratitude, or I wasn't even creating space for myself to like care for myself. And so I had to quickly identify. Sorry, this ringing sound is really bothering me. I don't know what it is. I had to really create space for myself to understand and learn what self-care looks like for me. And so now it is being like going back to community, being in community with the people that I love and that bring me joy, creating space for myself to unplug from the world. Like I made the decision this month, actually, November, to not be on social media. So I'm literally going to hand my Instagram password to one of my friends so that anything business related, like they'll handle it. But overall, like nobody's pressing me that much. Like I can take the month off of social media. And so that's something that I'm going to do because I just need to recognize like when it's time to unplug and really center and get back with self again. And so that's something that I'm going to be doing this month. And like just regarding myself and like, because I think I was starting to lose sight of even my why or, you know, what was fueling me. And it started to feel like more of a chore than something that I genuinely wanted to do, this work, and the work that I was doing overall. And so now it's figuring out, just doing a temperature check on like where I'm at and like silencing everything else that's going on around me and creating this space for myself to figure that out. So one, being in community with the people that I love and that bring me joy. Two, knowing and understanding when it's time to unplug. And three, fueling and feeding your hobbies. For me, I didn't really have many hobbies outside of work before, but after reaching that point of burnout, I'm like, yeah, this is not sustainable at all. So I've been just like exploring a lot of different hobbies for myself. And so I like cook now and I just signed up for like this boxing membership at this like boxing studio to do like boxing classes. And I like when it was warmer outside, I was going on daily walks. Now I don't really go as often because I just hate being cold. But that was something that I was doing a lot and that was really bringing me a lot of joy. And yeah, so cooking, my boxing. I tried Pilates recently and I liked it. It's really hard, but
Yes.
I liked it. It's also pretty expensive, but I think I'll go back and like get a membership as well. But that was something that was really fun. But yeah, I think just exploring and feeding those hobbies is really essential too.
Oh, okay. Thank you for sharing. And one quick question. Did you want to, did you only have 45 minutes for this? Because if that's cool, I can ask like one more question.
Oh no, I have more time. I have five.
Okay, perfect. Well, my next question was going to be about what is your freedom dream? So like, just your biggest dream for what the future could be, like unrestrained from reality. What would you want your ideal like world to look like?
I would say my freedom dream is a world that the things that we fight for don't have to seem as hard or far-fetched, where we aren't as led by like how the system has been ingrained and created. But we would live in a world where the system works for everyone. It positively impacts the people that are operating within it, that there's space for people to lead and show up authentically in all spaces and facets of life and government and whatever it may be. People are able to show up as their authentic selves and there's space for them to do so. We're represented in so many areas, in the highest areas, in the lowest areas, and that there's just representation for all, and that people are really just able to chase after the things that bring them joy, and aren't experiencing hurdles or aren't being stopped to experience them just because of what they may look like or where they may come from. But people are able to reach the heights that they aspire to reach off of the strength of it being something that fuels them and brings them joy instead of feeling like it's not attainable because of what they look like or where they come from.
That was beautiful. And I want to go back to this idea you mentioned a little earlier about the idea of the innocence of young Black girls and boys. Do you have any idea of how we could preserve that or if it's even possible in the society we live in?
I definitely think it's tough at this point in the society that we live in. It's actually funny. A few friends and I were having a conversation about this today. Because there's like a middle school that's on our campus. It's called, you know, Howard Middle School. And we're just like, wow, like these kids are grown, like something's in the milk or something because they're different. Like they're different. And we're like, at what point, we literally like ask, like, at what point, like, do we lose our innocence and like transition to these like individuals that are suddenly so aware of like the cruelties of the world and like sort of like in a way, like start to become it in a way. And just like, not like from, it doesn't always have to be from like the racism standpoint, but like, even just like they were fighting and we're just like, what is going on? And like the cussing, like it was just so crazy. And we're just like, at what point does this transition happen? And so I don't know if it's really possible at this point, because I think it's getting harder to preserve. Like I feel like before it was a little easier to preserve like a sense of innocence within children. But I think now, because everything is so in our faces and we really can't avoid it, like with social media, we're in such of a technology-driven space that you really can't escape it. And so I don't really know what that will look like at this point, because we are such a like technology-driven society and it is like in our face 24/7 and everything is at our fingertips. I don't know how realistic it is at this point, but
Well, this next question, I kind of have a follow-up to what you said. It might be, if it's too personal, we can just skip over it. But do you remember your moment of, like, losing innocence or...
I think something, actually, one of my first, like, experiences of recognizing, I think I recognized early on the role that like my identity played in the experiences that I had, because I was always in predominantly white settings. And so early on, as early as like, I will never forget this experience. I was in fifth grade. And that was like probably one of the most like, and I'm sure I experienced things a little earlier than fifth grade. I just don't really remember as much as I remember this experience. But I was in fifth grade and I, again, like was one of few black girls and black people within the school that I was going to. And there was a situation where we were in class and the teacher had like turned off the lights and one of the kids in the classroom was like, oh my God, where did Taraya go? And everyone like laughed. It was so crazy, like to experience as a little girl and like just immediately feeling so small and just like, wow, like I hate being a dark black girl. And I remember like going home and like crying to my mom about it. And my mom is like lighter skinned and my stepdad at the time, he's like darker skin. And I just like remember having a conversation with the two of them and about skin complexions and the beauty of our blackness. And like, because I started to internalize what I experienced within elementary school. And it was an entire conversation about like our identity as black people. And like, even just at that point, like learning more about racism and there being a conversation about the fact is that, you know, I may be treated differently because I am dark skinned and them telling me, but it doesn't take away from like the beauty and the power that's within me. And even that conversation was very eye opening to me. And that entire experience was very eye opening to me and how I perceived myself and also how I perceived the world around me. But I would say maybe that was like my first experience, first tangible experience, at least, and recognizing the role that being a dark-skinned black girl played for me in the world.
Thank you for sharing. I think it's so crazy how much like young black children you're forced to grow up so much sooner and to notice your differences so much sooner. But
absolutely,
other than that, I think I've mostly used all my questions. I've really been inspired by what you've said today. Do you have any other things you'd like to add, anything we didn't touch on?
I guess I can like just like not really. Maybe talk a little bit about like what I'm doing now at Howard.
Sure.
A lot of the work that I'm doing now at Howard has been like more focused around voting rights. So I am the president of the Howard University chapter of Black Girls Vote, and so a lot of the work that I do now is focused on getting Black students registered to vote and educated about the role that they have within voting, the power that's within their vote. And that's still something that's really important and has been really fueling work for me now because we play such a large role in the outcome of elections and the outcomes have a very, very, very immense impact on us as individuals and as a community. And so I've been just like really, really passionate about like getting students out to vote, registered to vote, because it's important work. And it's stuff that we really need to like have more of a sense of urgency around too.
And how did you first get involved with like your activism at Howard? Like, what was that transition like?
It actually was a pretty easy of a transition because I was doing so much my senior year of high school. So I knew that I wanted to keep the momentum going. And so I sort of came into Howard with that goal and my freshman year was a really interesting year because Howard, it was a lot going on with the campus. We had like a protest that was happening for like an entire semester. And a lot of things were like just on pause because we were still navigating the pandemic. And it was just a really weird semester. And so at least fall semester for us, my freshman year. And it was a different transition, but I just like was able to like just join different organizations and spaces. So I was like in the student advocacy department for like our student government, and just like advocating for the residents like within the dormitories, because the protest was really like around like the dormitories at Howard, and so like just advocating on that front. And then eventually like I found out about Black Roseville, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I need to be a part of this. And then I was, and then I eventually ran for president, and then now I'm just like still serving as president within the organization.
And is Black Girls Vote, is it attached to Howard, or is it a separate organization?
So it's a national chapter, and then we just have the Howard chapter of Black Girls Vote.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how else do you think, as a society, we can better support youth activists and change makers?
I would say listening to their stories, asking them, you know, what... continuing to ask the question of like, what do you need? How can we support? I think that's really important, to understanding like what the need is and like sort of doing that temperature check. I would also say, yeah, I think it just starts with hearing their stories, making space and amplifying their stories, and also doing the work to not just put it all on the people that are at the forefront, but sort of making an effort to lighten that load and doing what you can to support and also advocate and amplify whatever cause is being fought for.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad I got to hear about your recent work.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?